Glad you're here today. Thanks for coming. Odd things happening across the world again. This has been a wild week. Absolutely incredible. I don't know how many people actually kind of watched the 15-minute little movie of Muhammad that supposedly started all this stuff. It's a very sophomore. It's a poorly done movie. I mean, it's just so bad. But it brought up a whole lot of insulting points. It actually pulled facts straight out of history. But anyway, it was poorly done. So after you see on 9/11 in Cairo and Libya, the supposed protests against the movie, and as they rose up against the American embassies, you start looking at why all of this was going on. So in Libya, in Benghazi, of course, you saw that our ambassador and some other people were actually killed at that one. Cairo, they broke into the embassy compound. Nobody was injured or killed there. So you see that, and it's one of those things you just think, man, are they not getting it? Because our Secretary of State says, how could this happen? You know, we help these people liberate this country and save this city, and you're going, yeah, but they don't want us. I mean, they don't want freedom and democracy. They've said it before, and so this shouldn't surprise us. It's only if you're not calling these conflicts what they really are that you're surprised. And that's our problem, is that we are not still seeing this as a religious war, because the other side believes it is a religious war. That's all there is to it. And so when we're not willing to call it what it is, we're going to have a hard time understanding why they hate us so bad. So again, Cairo, Libya, then Tunisia, Oman, Sudan, Yemen, and a lot of other places there were protests, some of them much more violent than others. In fact, in Yemen and Sudan, we have sent in Marines to protect the embassy compounds, things like that in those areas. Now, again, it's interesting to see the uprisings on September 11th, and as we hear more about the killings in Libya, we're finding out that maybe that was a very coordinated attack, not just it. They probably used the film just as the reason for it. Again. The hatred is there, the impetus is there, they just wait for some trigger to blame it on and then attack. It's always there. So you see all of this going on, and then the big protest happened, of course, Friday after the noon prayers for Muslims. And I've always got a problem with how do you spend time in prayer and then go out and violently, we're losing something there. Something's not going right. Then people say, well, it was all against the film, the American film. And I've got some questions, because here's what happened. In Tripoli, Lebanon, they protested against the Pope. And they burned a KFC and another American restaurant. Now, why did they protest against the Pope? What did he have to do with that? And then on top of that, there were German and British embassies that were also attacked. Okay, now then, if this was an American film about Muhammad that upset everybody, then why were all these other people attacked? Okay? My point is that it's not just about the film. That was just the touch-off point. They're ready for any action, and whatever touch-off point that they need to start, this is what it seems that they do. They are protesting against Western civilization, especially Christianity. That's the undercurrent there. And so these things are why a lot of these things are happening. And I can't remember who said this, and this may not be the exact right words, but it fits, and that is, those who are uncertain of the validity of their faith react most violently when they're attacked. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. If you're unsure of where you're going to spend eternity, if you're unsure of the validity of your faith, you're going to be far more defensive. You're going to be far more aggressive in the defense of your faith. So it kind of makes sense when you see these things. All right, the only other thing is tonight at sundown is Rosh Hashanah for the Jewish people. This is the beginning of the year, the Jewish year 5773. So tonight at sundown, all across the world, Rosh Hashanah will be the new year for the Jews. And for those that don't know it, 5773 for the Jews, they say that that counts from the day of creation. They will admit that there are unknowns in there. They will admit that there. Some people argue if those are exact 24-hour days or time periods of creation that could make the 5,773 years much longer. They also base that on the generations that are found in the Bible, and they admit that maybe all of those generations aren't there, but they've been using this calendar for a long, long time. So this is the year 5773, starting tonight. Okay, so let's look at the book of Joel. See if any of this kind of looks familiar. My goodness. From last week, we read the first several verses, and Joel, the word Joel in Hebrew means the Lord is God, Yoel, and Joel is a reminder as well as a warning. So it's a reminder of where the Jewish people should be, the Israelites should be with their obedience to God, as well as a warning for if you don't turn back to God, here is what to expect. It is based on rebellion and staying away from God, or obedience and returning to God. Rebellion or return, it's your choice. From obedience, you, the Israelites, and the land will have blessings. For disobedience, you, the Israelites, and the land will be cursed. And over throughout the Bible, throughout history, all the way up to today, we see this going on. The question is, God asks the Israelites, he asks us today, how will you choose? How will you choose to follow God or not? If not, you can expect certain things. If you choose to follow God, you can expect certain promises from God. That's all there is to it. So my question last week was, does any of the things that are happening in the United States, climate-wise, economic-wise, terrorist-wise, does that have anything to do with maybe God sending a message to our nation that maybe we need to pay attention? Because there are so many similarities in the book of Joel with what's going on in our country today, I can't ignore it. I can't say that, yes, it is a definite warning from God, but I can't say, no, we need to forget that. Don't worry about it. I have to pay attention. That's all there is to it. In the first few verses, it talks about this plague of locusts, and it gets more detailed today. Evidently, a time in Joel's time where there was a plague of locusts in Israel. And one of the questions that is argued about over the book of Joel, is this an actual plague of locusts, or is this a future warning of a coming army that's invading, and it's just describing them as a plague of locusts? As we get into this, you can decide, because we'll spend a little more time here today. I want you to see in Deuteronomy 28, fifth book of the Bible. I want you to see that God already told them that this might happen, okay? So 800 years before Joel was written, God told them in Deuteronomy 28, 38. And God is telling the Israelites before he's bringing them into the promised land, if you obey me, you and the land will be blessed. If you disobey me, you and the land will be cursed, okay? And Deuteronomy 28:38, you will sow much seed in the field, but you will harvest little, because locusts will devour it. You will plant vineyards and cultivate them, but you will not drink the wine or gather the grapes, because worms will eat them. You will have olive trees throughout your country, but you will not use the oil, because the olives will drop off. You will have sons and daughters, but you will not keep them, because they will go into captivity. Swarms of locusts will take over all your trees and the crops of your land. So God has already warned them that one of the things that might happen whenever they turn against him is a plague of locusts. Okay? So when Joel comes along, this shouldn't be a surprise to the Israelites. And that's why I tend to be more literal in this interpretation of what Joel is talking about, is it's an actual plague of locusts in the time of Joel. And God is telling them, folks, I warned you about this. Are you coming back to me or not? Because here it is right in front of you. In fact, in verse 6, Joel 1, verse 6, he says, a nation has invaded my land, powerful and without number. It has the teeth of a lion, the fangs of a lioness. Okay? So he describes it as a nation. So some people say, see, this is emblematic of an actual nation that it was so numerous it was like a plague of locusts. I think just the opposite. I believe it was a plague of locusts that he describes like a well-organized army that is attacking. Now then, if you look in chapter 2, verse 4, here's a little bit more, you know, emphasis on in description of this plague. He says, they have the appearance of horses. They gallop along like cavalry with a noise that like that of chariots. They leap over the mountaintops like a crackling fire, consuming stubble, like a mighty army drawn up for battle. So he is describing this plague of locusts as an army. Now then, what's interesting, if you look over in Revelation 9, see, this is just all the way through the... From beginning to end, these things keep popping up. So from Revelation 9, and if you go through the sequence of the plagues and the judgment, everything in Revelation, starting with the seals, the trumpets, the bowls that are poured out. Okay, so in Revelation 9, this is the fifth trumpet. So winding is with each progression of seal that's opened, with each progression of trumpet that's opened, whatever is happening is getting worse and worse. It's leading up to the final wrath of God being poured out in the bowl judgments. So here's the fifth angel blowing the angel's trumpet, and in verse 3 it talks about, and out of the smoke locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. Okay, so one of the trumpet judgments has to do with this horrible plague of locusts. And then verse 7, it says, the locusts looked like horses prepared for battle. On their heads they wore something like crowns of gold, and their faces resembled human faces. Their hair was like a woman's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. See, all of these similarities between Joel, about 600 B.C., 4 to 600 B.C., and then John writing in the later part of the 1st century A.D., and here it is again. And John is looking something far into the future. And yet he's seeing a plague of locusts that look like an army. Okay? That's exactly what Joel was saying. Again, it says, they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. All those key words keep popping up. They had tails and stings like scorpions, and in their tails they had power to torment people for 5 months. They had as king over them the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek, Apollyon the Destroyer. This was what was driving the plagues of locusts in Revelation. Will be driving the plagues of locusts in Revelation. All right, so you see all the similarities to Joel. All right, so the question comes up is, well, is Joel describing an event that was going on at Joel's time, or is Joel a book that's describing the exact same thing in the distant future that John is describing? The very end times. What do you think? Or does it matter? What's that? Better pay attention either way. But I mean, you know, does it matter? Now, what's interesting about God's prophecies all the way through the Bible is that most every prophecy that's given, there's a near-term fulfillment and a long-term fulfillment. And the near-term fulfillment is almost like a precursor, or the one key word is archetype. Meaning, God's saying, I'm going to show you a little bit about what you're in for. I'm going to give you just a hint. If you don't shape up, it's going to be sort of like this. And that's what I was telling you last week. last spring when we had that plague of moths in Amarillo. I mean, if that is just a little hint of something far worse that God is saying, you know, you better shape up or else, then I want to pay attention, because those moths drove me crazy, and I can't imagine, you know, a huge plague full of those things all over them. And so is this a precursor? It can be both. And I believe it was something in Joel's time that God gave them at that moment to wake them up. And he is saying, folks, I tell you again in Revelation, if you don't shape up now, if you think this is bad, wait till you see the locusts of the end times. They're going to be able to sting like scorpions. They're going to be far worse than what I'm showing Joel. So I think that this is an indication of God's over and over, all the way through the Bible, giving us chances to turn back to him. And he's giving examples of what it's going to be like without him, and he will give us examples what it's going to be like with him. You better choose. And so this is a great example of how horrible it can be. This is just a snapshot. The other thing that I want to look at that is just really fascinating in the book of Joel is several times in here, in 6 and 7, chapter 1, 6 and 7, he says, a nation has invaded my land, it has laid waste my vines, and ruined my fig trees. Then if you look over in 2:18, he says, then the Lord will be jealous for his land. And then in 3:2, and we're going to talk about all these later, he says, I'll bring all the nations down into judgment concerning my inheritance, my people Israel, and for dividing up my land. Do you think God is interested in his land?
Yes.
Now again, you think, well, God owns the whole universe. Why would he possibly still be interested, especially in 2012 AD? Why is God still interested in this little tiny piece of land somewhere over in the Middle East? I mean, why should he concern himself with that? Why would his judgment on the future of nations be based on how they divided up his land? What's so important about that? Yes, Donna.
That was God's first covenant. They were his people. That was his land.
Yes.
And he never goes back on a covenant. It also said he gave a promise. Oh, bless you, curse those that curse you.
Yep.
That is forever. Whoever goes against Israel will be cursed.
Okay. So what Donna says, from day one, God evidently thought it was important enough to make a blood covenant with the nation of Israel that included this piece of land. And he refers to it as my land all the way through the Bible. It's my land. And it's a fascinating to look at his prophecies, God speaking to the prophets all the way through there. How important, God even talks directly to the land in Ezekiel and other places. God is speaking directly to his land. And he is evidently so interested in his land that he continually says, you don't mess with my land. You don't carve it up. You don't divide it. Evidently, he was so interested in having the nation of Israel also being included in the land of Israel that he said, like Donna says, you bless them, I'll bless you. You curse them, and I'll curse you. You don't mess with my people. You don't mess with my land. You know, that is just amazing to see that, you know, gosh, all these many years later, surely that land isn't important. To God, evidently it is. For some reason. And it has to do with his blood covenant. He cannot go back on his word. He said that this land would be yours everlasting. Everlasting. Still includes 2012 AD. So all the way through there, he's talking about my land, my fig trees, this belongs to me. This is all mine. It's interesting to look in, like in Jeremiah, God accuses Israel of defiling his land. He says, Israel, you have defiled my land with your idols. So Israel, you have insulted my land. You have brought an ulcer on my land by putting your detestable idols on my land. That's powerful. And you know, he tells Israel too, all the way back in Deuteronomy, he says, you know, there will come a time when you're going to rebel against me and the land will be cursed. He says, I'm going to scatter you outside of this land to all the nations of the world. And he says, and while you're gone, the land is going to rest. The land is going to rest. So that when I bring you back, the land is going to bloom and produce and be blessed. So, see, part of the process with God in Israel is always having to do with the land. It's always an integral part of his ideas and his thoughts for Israel. Turn to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 7, 18. God is saying, I will establish your royal throne as I covenanted with David, your father. So he's talking to Solomon as he's setting up the temple. With David, your father, when I said, you shall never fail to have a man to rule over Israel. But if you turn away and forsake the decrees and commands I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, okay? So if you turn away from me and your people turn away from me, what am I going to do? Well, then I will uproot Israel from my land, which I have given them, and will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. I will make it a byword. And remember these little things here because they're going to come up later in Joel. His name, a byword, and an object of ridicule among all peoples. That's going to come up again in Joel. And though this temple is now so imposing, all who pass by it will be appalled and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple? So people from outside notice something happening with the land, and their question is, why has God done this horrible thing to this land? So God is doing this himself. People will answer, because they have forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of Egypt and have embraced other gods, worshiping and serving them. That is why he brought all this disaster on him. So it's the outsiders are going to notice that something is amiss in the land of Israel. Does that sound like today? You see everything going on and people are going, gosh, what? Yeah. Why is everybody against Israel? And the question is, well, where's that God that's supposed to protect them? That's exactly the question is asking Joel. Where's their God? And what has happened to the land? And it's amazing to see what happened to the land of Israel from 70 AD when the temple was destroyed and the Jews were scattered up until about 1900 AD when the Jews started returning. It was a wasteland. It was a wasteland. It was a barren wasteland. When the Jews began to come back, drain the swamps, clean up the land, agriculture, bring in drip irrigation, all of a sudden, just like Isaiah says, the desert started to bloom. So here we have this, you know, time in Deuteronomy where he warns them that'll happen. Here it is in Joel when it's evidently happening. And he's telling them, okay, where are you going to decide? Are you going to go for the wasteland? Or are you going to go for the fruitful land? It's your choice. So God meant from the beginning for the people of Israel to be one with the land of Israel, and it's his everlasting covenant. He's serious about it. It is all the way up to the end of time. He tells them in verse 8, he says, mourn like a virgin in sackcloth, grieving for the husband of her youth. Grain offerings and drink offerings are cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests are in mourning, those who minister before the Lord. The fields are ruined, the ground is dried up, the grain is destroyed, the new wine is dried up, the oil fails. Despair, you farmers, wail, you vine growers, grieve for the wheat and the barley because the harvest of the field is destroyed. The vine is dried up and the fig tree is withered, the pomegranate, the palm, and the apple tree, all the trees of the field are dried up. Surely the joy of mankind is withered away. He says, mourn like a virgin. This is a woman that is betrothed to a husband to be married, and he dies before they can actually be married. He says, mourn that deeply. And then anybody know what sackcloth is? If you've grown up in the Texas Panhandle, you probably know what sackcloth is. Burlap, you know, type. Yeah. And some of you may have even worn something made out of burlap. Sackcloth was kind of the same way, except it was made mainly out of goat hair, but it was worn next to the skin as purposefully as an irritant. So like wearing burlap right next to the skin, purposefully to keep you irritated and ever mindful of your loss while you're in mourning. It is an irritant. And so that's what he's saying. Put on sackcloth. You need to mourn deeply. That's what this is. That's what it's about. And he says, not even enough from the produce of the land to bring grain offerings and drink offerings to the temple. That was one of the first commandments that God told them, was bring the first of your crop, the first of your wine to the temple. The first go to the Lord. It's so bad that they can't even do that. Those have been withheld from the temple. So the priests are in mourning because they can't even perform the worship rites that are directed by God himself. And finally, with all that's going on, everything is dried up, withered, or destroyed. Absolutely, the joy of mankind itself is withered away. Yep. If you've been a farmer or rancher anywhere in this area, you understand the joy has been withered away the last couple of years. It has been here in the United States. The next section of these verses address, the first section address the elders, the leaders of Israel. The next section of verses address the priests, so the spiritual leaders of Israel. And he tells them first, you put on sackcloth, O priests, and mourn. Wail, you who minister before the altar. Come, spend the night in sackcloth, you who minister before my God. For the grain offerings and drink offerings are withheld from the house of your God. Declare a holy fast. Call a sacred assembly. Summon the elders and all who live in the land to the house of the Lord your God, and cry out to the Lord. Alas for that day, for the day of the Lord is near. So this is the first time we see day of the Lord. We'll come back to that. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Has not the food been cut off before our very eyes? Joy and gladness from the house of our God. The seeds are shriveled beneath the clods. The storehouses are in ruins. The granaries have been broken down, for the grain is dried up. How the cattle moan. The herds mill about because they have no pasture. Even the flocks of sheep are suffering. To you, O Lord, I call. For fire has destroyed the open pastures, and flames have burned up all the trees of the field. Even the wild animals pant for you. The streams of water have dried up, and fire has devoured the open pastures. Now, if you can read this and not think about what's going on in the United States, I'm missing something. Man, this is so incredibly fitting. Drought, wildfires, rivers drying up. Just saw that on the news. I can't remember which river it was. That was just Thursday or Friday. I can't tell you how many people I know that are ranchers who have had to sell their cattle because they can't afford to feed them. The most affordable hay has been trucked in from Canada. That's terrible. So you got to sell the cattle. Now then, there is an interesting correlation. There's a couple things in Lamentations. So go over to Lamentations. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations. So just a few pages back. Now, Lamentations, Jeremiah was writing Lamentations while Israel was in captivity in Babylon. And so it's a very mournful book, lamenting all their loss. Now, since we're not exactly sure when Joel was written, it could have been written before Jeremiah wrote Lamentations, could have been written after, we're not exactly sure. But there's a couple things in here that talk about this time period that are fitting, and how it affects the priests Okay, so in Lamentations 1:4, it says, "The roads to Zion mourn, for no one comes to her appointed feasts. All her gateways are desolate, her priests groan, her maidens grieve, and she is in bitter anguish." Okay, so that is very reflective of what Joel is saying. The priests are in mourning. Okay, the priests are mourning because they can no longer serve. They're groaning. And then in Lamentations 1:19, he said, "I called to my allies, but they betrayed me. My priests and my elders perished in the city while they searched for food to keep themselves alive." Okay? All right, so my question is, if you look in Joel and he's talking about the priests who should be mourning, why would the priests be looking for food? Why would the priests be looking for food? Okay, the priests did not own land. They were dependent totally on the grain and drink offerings that were brought by the people. And what did it say about the grain and drink offerings? They're being withheld. They're dried up. So how are the priests living? Well, you know, Lamentations, Jeremiah says, they're searching the city. They're perishing because they can't find any food. Makes all the sense in the world. Joel is saying, priests, you better start mourning because the grain and drink offerings aren't coming in. When people, think about this. See if it has anything to do with the United States or the church or anything. Whenever you're in economic straits, what is usually the first thing that you cut off? Given to your church. That's probably the last thing we ought to cut off, but it's usually the first thing that goes. These people are struggling to maintain a living, to feed their families. First thing they're going to do is forget that grain offering, drink offering. We need it here. We need to keep my family alive. When they do that, the priests that have been instituted by God, they're out looking for food. That's how bad it gets. That's how bad it's getting. That's why Joel makes such a, you know, intent comparison with that. All right,
well,
then.
The hungrier our government gets, the more they come down on the churches. Yes.
That is so fascinating. Marilyn, as usually in her wonderful wisdom, the hungrier our government gets, the sooner they will come down on churches and things. And they've already been talking about, should we eliminate itemized deductions? And I've said before, we'll find out where your heart is in giving to God if that's the case. Will you still give if that itemized deduction is gone? There you go. Here we are in Joel. Here we are in Joel. Where's your heart? All right, now then, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about and kind of getting set of the day of the Lord. This is the first mention in verse 15 about the day of the Lord. All right, now as you were reading through Joel, and it mentions the day of the Lord five different times, and just from your studies and things, how many people believe that the day of the Lord is an extended period of time sometime in the future? How many believe that it's an actual day where something begins? A few more people. The rest of you just don't have a clue. Well, the other one, the other possibility is, are there days of the Lord throughout history? Okay, and another thought process is, are we in the day of the Lord now? Since Christ has come, is that the church age? Okay, so that's a possibility. If you believe in pre-tribulational rapture, if you believe that when the end times come, the final seven-year period that's described in Daniel, if you believe that the church is going to be raptured before that begins, then pre-tribulation rapture teaches that that entire seven-year period is the day of the Lord. Okay? Because we are exempt from God's wrath. And they believe that entire 7-year period is God's wrath, so the church has to be gone. Okay? That's one way to look at it. The other possibility is, no, there's an exact day when God's wrath is poured out on the earth. I believe it's after the midpoint of the 7-year period, and it begins with the bowl judgments, because it says the bowls of God's wrath are poured out on the earth. And so that would be the day of the Lord when his final judgment comes. Then why are they warning the Israelites in Joel's time about the day of the Lord that's on top of them? Okay. Again, it seems to me that throughout history, God has talked about days of the Lord at different times to give us an archetype of, you think this is bad? Wait till the last one. And so he's given Israel, he's given the world chance after chance after chance and warned them about a coming judgment. And all of these instances are just a snapshot of what the final is going to be like. So there's a lot of different thought processes. There's a lot of different ways to see it. Possibilities, we don't know for a fact. But as we go through this, I want you to see how the day of the Lord is described in Joel, and does it fit with other descriptions of the day of the Lord throughout the rest of the Bible. So what I want to do is to look at verse 15 and tell me, what is the day of the Lord? Is it, what kind of a day is it? A day of destruction. A day of destruction from Almighty God. Okay? All right, so that day of the Lord sounds pretty frightening. Okay? It's a day of destruction from Almighty God. Then I want you to turn to, and we won't get through these, but I just want to read one of them, and this is Isaiah. So, Isaiah 13. So Isaiah was written, say, 750 years before Christ, so at least 150, 200 years before Joel. Okay? So Isaiah came quite a bit before the book of Joel. In Isaiah 13, this is a short-term prophecy of Babylon. Okay? Because Babylon didn't happen until beginning in like 600 BC. They went captive. The temple was destroyed in 586. So Isaiah was being written well before the Babylon captivity. And it says, an oracle concerning Babylon that Isaiah son of Amoz saw. Raise a banner on a bare hilltop. Shout to them. Beckon to them to enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my holy ones. I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath. Those who rejoice in my triumph. Listen, a noise on the mountains like that of a great multitude. Listen, an uproar among the kingdoms like nations massing together. The Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. Well, there's that army for war. They come from faraway lands, from the ends of the heavens, the Lord in the weapons of his wrath to destroy the whole country. What whole country? Remember, he's talking about my land, God's land. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like, what? Destruction from the Almighty. There it is, word for word, that Joel says. Destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every man's heart will melt. Terror will seize them. Pain and anguish will grip them. They will rise like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at each other, their faces aflame. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger to make what? The land up. There it is again. What happens to Israel? The land and the people seem to go together. The land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. Oh, man. So that means that in the day of the Lord, sinners are going to be destroyed? It sounds like it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. So there's a time coming that God says, I'm going to judge and I'm going to put an end to evil. Final. I'm going to judge and destroy all sinners. Okay, so again, here's a good point of, we know that the early fulfillment of this prophecy was Israel being carried into Babylon. It says so. But the long term is, there's going to be a final day when God judges all the earth. And he is going to take action against all evil and destroy those who do not believe. There's a day coming for that. So here's the near term and the long term prophecy. And look at all the similarities with what Joel is describing also. And it gets better. We'll get into that next week. There are several things that come up with the description of the day of the Lord that are all the way through the Bible from beginning to end. We'll look at those. Because then that helps you to start seeing what is God talking about on this special day and why. Okay? Keep going. Keep reading. So we'll look at these other verses next week. Any questions or comments? And so as you read the news and see what all is going on, you think, okay, how close is that day of the Lord? It's getting tight. Let's have a prayer. Our Almighty God, we thank you so much for your word. It is so exciting to see what you have been telling all mankind throughout history. God, when we read these things today, 2,000 years after the birth of your son, and see how applicable they are, we know that you're still shouting to the entire world, please return, please return. God, help us to get our hearts right, our wisdom that we need to live each day according to your word, God. Give us that strength to endure all things. Help us to see with your eyes your perspective of eternity. We need you in these days. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank y'all for being here.